It's time now for our Africa update. Have you heard of the Western Sahara? It's one of the least populated areas in the world, and for decades, this tiny piece of land has been at the center of a tug of war. For more, we've got Bill Fletcher, a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and former president of the Trans-Africa Forum. Hi, Bill.
Glad to be back.
Yeah, good to see you in person.
Thank you.
We don't hear much about Western Sahara. Most of the people there are both Arabic and Spanish. Why?
It's that they speak Arabic and Spanish. They are largely nomadic. And in the 1880s, Spanish, as part of the division of Africa, grabbed this section of North Africa and held it until 1975.
And its neighbor, Morocco, is a Francophone country.
Precisely. And Morocco has always laid claim to the Western Sahara. And whereas Mauritania to the south gave up that that territory, the Moroccans have insisted on keeping control.
What has that produced in terms of conflict?
War. The war actually began in the early 1970s when the Spanish was still there. When the Spanish withdrew, the Sahrawi people carried out a war against both the Moroccans and the Mauritanians. They signed a peace with the Mauritanians. The Moroccans refused to give up. And in fact, at a certain point in 1975, King Hassan II sent 350,000 Moroccan civilians into the Western Sahara in order to settle the territory. So the war continued up until 1991 when there was a ceasefire. It's not been resolved.
Now, what role has the U.S. played in trying to mediate this or taking sides?
A little bit of both. In the beginning, because Morocco was a very close Cold War ally of the United States sided with Morocco in grabbing this land. Then in the 1990s, former Secretary of State James Baker was appointed by the United Nations to be a special envoy to try to mediate the solution to the crisis, and spent several years doing this, resigned in frustration when the Moroccans kept breaking the agreements. Most recently, however, there's been an ominous cloud, which is that the Moroccans have said that Western Sahara should be an autonomous province, and there are a growing number of people in Congress that are saying, yes, that's right.
Now, who's going to negotiate this, if anyone?
This needs to continue to be conducted through the United Nations. There really is no other broker that I think can do this, although pressure from the African Union certainly could help if it was moved against the Moroccans. The problem that we face, though, is that if there is a developing poll of opinion on Capitol Hill that's supporting the Moroccan position, the Moroccans may feel that they have no reason to compromise. Thus, war will continue.
What stake does the U.S. have either in Morocco or the Western Sahara in that region, period?
There's economic, political, and strategic. Economically, phosphates, which were discovered in large quantities in the early 1960s in the Western Sahara. Morocco has been a close ally, some would call it a puppet of the United States, for years. So that's a second factor. The third thing has to be situated in this so-called war against terrorism, where anywhere in the Arabic-speaking world, there is this complete paranoia within the United States that Al-Qaeda may surface. And what's happening is the Moroccans are trying to disparage the liberation forces in West Sahara, calling them terrorists.
Is there any basis for that?
None. Polisario, which is the liberation movement that leads a struggle there in Western Sahara, is not at all an Islamist group. They were certainly influenced by Marxism, but not at all by political Islam. And their chief national ally is Algeria. And Algeria has fought a tough war, as you know, against Islamic terrorists. So there is no basis. It's simply defamation.
Now, the Western Sahara has been on the United Nations list of non-self-governing territories since the 60s. What the heck does that mean?
It means they're a colony. It means basically that they're a colony and that they should be achieving national self-determination. The Moroccans and their French allies, however, keep blocking this. And so when King Hassan II sent in 350,000 people, what he was hoping to do was to quite literally change the demographics of the Western Sahara so that when a referendum was held, people would vote to remain with Morocco. But there's an irony here. Many of those settlers are not very pleased with Morocco, and so Morocco doesn't even want to have a referendum now.
In some ways, is this parallel to China and Tibet in terms of this whole idea of repopulating an area being a political strategy?
It's very similar to China, Tibet, to Israel and Palestine. The sending in settlers, there's a security wall that the Moroccans set up in Western Sahara that divides the country and was based off of discussions that the Moroccan leadership actually had with the Israelis. So this strategy is not unique to what Morocco has done. You're precisely right in what we see in Tibet.
Now, last week, the UN Refugee Agency made an urgent appeal for more funding of the camps in Western Sahara and Algeria. Why is this? Tell us about the refugee situation.
Refugee situation has been quite severe ever since the Spanish pulled out. Because when the Spanish pulled out and the Moroccans and Mauritanians attacked, people, en masse, the indigenous people, left and started going to Algeria, where they settle in refugee camps. And very few of them have been able to return. So you're talking about people that have been there for three decades, nearly four decades. So you have that situation. The second problem is, to put it bluntly, very few people care about the Western Sahara. And even in the Arab world, there's a great degree of silence about what's happening there. So the Western Sahara, even though the government, the interim government of the Sahrawi people, is recognized by more than 80 countries, it's not like you have a significant global movement that's insisting that something needs to be done. That therein lies the problem. These refugees could be there until the cows come home.
Well, let's move on to another part of North Africa. It's a new turn of events for Libya. The nation was granted a two-year term on the Security Council starting on January 1st, and the U.S. once condemned Libya as a state sponsor of terrorism. Are you surprised by this vote?
No, I wasn't surprised. It's been coming in many ways for a while. When the Libyans both decided to settle the Pan Am claim around a Lockerbie bombing, and when the Libyans renounced weapons of mass destruction, it laid the basis for this turn of events. I guess the other part is that the Libyans under President Gaddafi have been very frustrated by the isolation that they found themselves in over the last 20 years, and particularly with the end of the Cold War. And so, President Gaddafi has started to put more attention actually on Africa. But also there's been pressure within Libya for a greater rapprochement with the rest of the world. So I'm not surprised.
So when we talk about this, though, there are members on the Security Council that have veto power. What about Libya?
Well, Libya is not a permanent member of the Security Council. That's the thing to keep in mind. So they are there only for a limited term. Although you raise a very interesting point, because Libya, along with many other members of the African Union, have been demanding a permanent space at the Security Council table.
Well, Bill, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
Bill Fletcher is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and the former president of Trans-Africa Forum. He spoke with us from NPR's Washington, D.C. headquarters.
And to pull your window curtains.